There's a story told about a fellow who was going around collecting for his institution. So he knocks on a particular door, and he says, "You know, I'm here every year. You normally give me $100. Can you give me $100 this year for my institution?" So the man says, "Hold on one second." 5 minutes later, comes back, and he gives him a check for $85. So the collector says, "What's going on? You normally give me 100. Why'd you give me 85?" So he said, "Well, you know, I went online and I looked up your institution and I see that it no longer exists. So I'm giving you 85 instead of 100. He said, "Well, if my institution no longer exists, why'd you give me any money?" He said, "I didn't want you to lose your share." So when we talk about collecting money for institutions, it's not just a question of who to support, but how to figure out a way to fund these institutions, some of which we'll talk about which types of institutions, but these institutions are very necessary for everyone or almost everyone, and different people will have different views in terms of where the money should come from. And we'll see different models that are presented in the Talmud, and the discussions, and I thought it's interesting, the discussions that come up are very similar to the kind of discussions that you'll find around the boardroom table or around the Shabbos table or in the back of the shul. All the arguments that people have for different approaches in terms of how to fund things, these are not new arguments. These have been going on for a while. So I'm going to discuss... I'll do three case studies. Okay, case one. You have a small shul, let's say 100 members, and they're presented with the following dilemma. So about half the members of the shul want to renovate the shul because they're bursting at the seams, and new members can't come to the shul just because there's no room. So you have a 100 member shul, they want to grow, so half of them want to grow to 200, 250, and the other half say, "Wait a second, if we're going to spend all this money to renovate the shul, who do you think is going to pay for it? It's going to come out of membership fees or a capital campaign or something, and we don't have the money. It's, you know, the economy's not good right now. We don't want to spend that extra money to grow the shul. We're happy with our 100 member shul, our small building. Why renovate the shul? Why create financial problems for the institution and for us, meaning the members?" So the rabbi's called in to mediate, or somebody's called in to mediate. What kind of advice can we tell them? Is there a solution, or is there a model we can come up with that will satisfy everyone? Okay, case number two. For years, again, a small shul, let's say this shul's even smaller, 50 members, and they have a weekly kiddush. And you know, when you're a small shul, you don't necessarily have a custodial staff, so every week there was a different family that took turns cleaning up the room after the kiddush. So that was working out just fine until some people said, "You know what? The week that I'm on, I want to pay for a custodian." And then what happened is that over time it made sense for the people who were hiring the custodian to say, "Look, you know, it pays for us to hire somebody for the whole year, every week, week in, week out. It'll be cheaper for us who are too lazy to clean up ourselves." And therefore, they want to impose on everybody to just pay the fee. You know, it's going to come out of membership dues. So everyone should pay because it makes sense for those who are paying right now. So can the group who wants the custodian force those who are willing to volunteer and clean up themselves to add to their membership dues for that purpose? Case number three is a community with, let's say, 8 shuls, and they have an Eruv. Now, the way the Eruv worked normally was that there was a flat fee. Each shul, let's say, paid whatever it was, $1,000 a year. And that was enough because the Eruv was a very low maintenance Eruv. You have, here, you know, we have a lot of wind, and the Eruv falls down a lot. But in some places, like in Queens, a lot of the Eruv is just walls. So, you know, either walls or electric wires that if they fall, somebody else will replace them. So it's a low-cost Eruv. Now all of a sudden something happens and the city decides they're changing things around, and now there's a major expense coming up. So traditionally, the shuls, each shul would pay a flat fee. But like everything else, you know, some shuls have 50 members and some shuls have 600 members. So the smaller shuls are saying, "Wait a second, why are we paying now that we have this major expense as opposed to $1,000? Now you're asking every shul to pay whatever it is, $3,000. So now a major $36,000 expense to renovate the whole Eruv. So why should the shul with 50 members have to pay the same as the shul with the 600 members? It should be split based on how many people there are on the shul. And the people and the other shul, the bigger shul, will say, wait a second. The tradition always was that each shul paid a flat fee, so keep it the way it is. So how would you resolve that dilemma? Case four. A local bank is offering to give money to the shul if you open up an account. Just joking. Okay. So we're going to discuss these three cases. Let's turn to the models presented in the Gemara. I don't have all the sources in the source sheet, but there are a few. So the first one is not in there. The Gemara in Baba Basra talks about the way to fund a wall for a city. It's Baba Basra 7b. Okay, so the Gemara Baba Basra 7b talks about the way to fund a wall for a city. And there are basically three options presented in the Gemara. One is a flat rate for each person in the city. We need a wall to protect from, again, this was in earlier times, they didn't have police protection. We need a wall to protect outsiders from coming in and robbing us, and therefore everyone has to pay a flat rate, no matter what your financial situation, no matter what your, no matter how close you are to the edge of the city or not, everyone pays a flat fee. Number two is based on wealth. Now, when we say based on wealth, so the first thing that might come to mind is, well, the people who can afford more should pay more, the people who can afford less should pay less. We'll discuss that, but that's not what's going on here. Because here, the reason why should the wealthier people pay more? Because if they get robbed, so then they stand to lose more money. The people who are not as wealthy, if they get robbed, they'll lose less. Now, what would come out in this model is that, let's say somebody's very wealthy, but all his money is not in the city. He's keeping it in a different city. So in that city, he'll have to pay more for the wall. But in the current city he lives in, he only has a few dollars hanging around, so he wouldn't have to pay as much. So it's not a wealth model based on, meaning it's not based on assistance or anything like that. It's just based on trying to make things fair for everybody. The people who stand to lose more should pay more because they have more on the line, meaning they need the wall more than the people who aren't as wealthy. I mean, nowadays it would be interesting because you wouldn't really necessarily talk about wealth, but people who carry cash versus people who don't carry cash, or people have more assets on their property than anything else. And then the third model that the Gemara presents is based on distance to the edge of the city, meaning if a robber is going to attack the city, he's more likely to attack the outskirts of the city so he can get out quicker than to go into the middle of town. So if you live closer to the edge of the city, you'll pay more for the wall. If you live towards the middle of the city, you won't pay as much. Okay, so those three models basically are figuring out. Flat fee would just be flat fee. That's one model that you go by. You treat everyone equally. That's like membership in a shul. Everyone's treated equally. You pay a membership, and that covers the costs. The other two approaches are basically the same, just trying to figure out who benefits more from the wall. So either you say that the people who have more money inside the city benefit more, or you say people who are closer to the edge of the city benefit more. But each one, there are two permutations in terms of figuring out who's benefiting from the wall. Okay, in source one, in the source sheets, let me just make sure I have the same one. Okay, that's Baba Kama 116b. The Gemara talks about people who get lost in the desert. Okay, so they get lost in the desert, and somebody's threatening to rob them. So the Gemara says that they walk through the desert, and the band of robbers threatened to plunder it. The contribution would be paid based on their possessions. Now again, it's not a wealth model. It's not that the wealthier people can afford it, but we're talking about here either you're talking about bribing them, meaning I don't know why the robbers would be ready to accept a bribe. Usually it's all or nothing, but they're willing to, you know, whatever. They're willing to be appeased for a certain amount of money. So who should pay in the end of the day? So I don't know how this works, but they managed to appease them with a certain amount of money. So everyone stood to lose all their possessions. So whoever worked it out maybe should get a little prize, but in the end of the day, you should divide it based on, you know, percentage-wise in terms of what everyone stood to lose. And you don't go based on a flat fee. You don't split it equally among all the people. Okay. But if they had to hire a guide to get them out of the desert, meaning they're lost in the desert and they needed to hire somebody to get them out, so then you figure it out based on a flat fee. Why? Because everybody needs to get out equally. It's not that I'm more important so I should pay more and my life is worth more money, or my life is worth less so I should pay less. Everyone's the same. You have to get out of the desert. Now, why does the Gemara say aflafi anafashos, even according to monies? So why does the Gemara say aflafi anafashos, meaning even according to a flat fee? It sounds like it's a hybrid model, that some people, meaning that you'll split it somewhat based, 50%, let's say, based on that, and that's what Rabbeinu Asher says, 50% of the cost based on how much money they have, and 50% based on a flat fee. So the Meiri, this is the Meiri on this Gemara, it's not in the source sheet, writes that if you hire a guide just to take you out of the desert, it's cheaper than if you hire him to protect your money. Meaning, this guide, again, they're not, in this case, they're not bribing the robbers. They're hiring a guy to take them out of the. They're hiring a guide to take them out of the desert. So you can hire an armed guard, or you can hire a regular guy who just knows the way out. So if you hire somebody who offers protection as well, so the protection piece should be based on how much money people stand to lose. So if you stand to lose a lot of money, you should pay more than the other part. But if you're just trying to get out of the desert, So then you're just trying to get out of the desert, everyone splits it evenly. Now, we'll discuss in a minute why it should be that Rabbeinu Asher nevertheless writes that it's a the Shita Megubetzis writes that it's a flat fee no matter what, that everyone will pay a flat fee. Why don't we consider the fact that money is also involved here and that people stand to lose money as well? Yeah, you know.
Rabbeinu Asher is saying,
Rabbeinu Asher says that you hire, meaning this case, whatever it, this case is, you hire a guide to get you out of the, you hire the guide to get you out of the desert, and he says that you pay 50, meaning you split the, if let's say the guide costs $1,000, so $500 will be split evenly amongst the people, and the other $500 will be based on how much they stood to lose.
Yeah.
No, he doesn't. No conditions. So that's just what he says. And then
he's also the guide. Besides being the guide, he's also protecting you.
So the Meiri is the one who says that. Nobody else seems to. The question is, why is it only the Meiri? It seems very logical that if you hire the guide, only right. If you hire him just to get you out, so then it should be flat-fee. That seems to be the most logical. You hire him to get you out, so everyone splits it evenly. You hire him to protect your money, so that portion of the cost should be split based on wealth. But nobody else says that. So we'll see in a minute why that should be. Okay. Let's get to that question now. Tosos, on the original case of the wall around the city, so Tosos asked the following question. We know it's an established principle that when robbers come into town, it's not just money that's at stake. Meaning, you're going to tell me that we should base the whole model, assuming we go with the wealth model, that we should base the security wall based on money. But in the end of the day, people's lives are on the line, because there's going to be somebody in the city who says, you know what, you're not taking my money, you're going to have to kill me before you get the money. Whether most people will do that, whether minority people will do that, people will do that. People will say, you are not, you know, when the robber comes, you're not taking my money. And it could involve the whole community. And meaning if it comes down to a fight, it might not just be the guy who stands up for his money. There may be other people involved. So why don't you take that into consideration as well? Meaning when you're putting up the security wall, when you're putting up the security wall, so you should say, okay, a portion of it should be based on the fact that there are wealthier people who have more to lose. But a portion of it should be that it protects us from from life-threatening situations as well. And in fact, you don't know who it's going to be, but there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. I'll give you an example. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that I believe this is an Or HaChaim Siman Shin Chaf Tes. 329 about the it's either one I might be one off on that, but the halacha is that if people come to attack your city on Shabbos, so in theory, if they're only coming for money, you should just, you know, you can't go out with weapons and start shooting. But the halacha is that you're allowed to defend yourself even if they're just coming after money. Why? You're not allowed to violate Shabbos to save your money, but the assumption is that when you have marauders coming into town, that it's never going to be just about the money. That it's inevitable that people will start standing up for their property, and they're entitled to do that. That's a separate discussion, maybe for a different time. They're entitled to do that, and therefore, we could assume that it's already a case of pikuach nefesh. So that's the basis of Tosa's question. And Tosa says that basically the answer is that we go by the initial intent of the rob, meaning the initial, what's the primary goal of putting up the fence is to protect your money. What are we worried about? The primary intent of the ganav? The ganav is coming to take your money. So you figure out what your primary intent is. So when you hire the guide, getting back to our case of the guide, when you hire the guide, you have to figure out what's your primary purpose in hiring the guide. So if the primary purpose of hiring the guide is to get you out of the desert, and you don't even think about the fact that he also happens to have a weapon on him, so then forget about the money. Meaning that was why you hired the guy. You hired the guy because you're lost in the desert, and you don't know, how to get home. Actually happened to me last night. Somebody came up to me. Older couple came up to me in Publix. They didn't know how to get home. So, and they happened to tell me where they live at the beginning. But by the end of the conversation, they forgot where they themselves were living. So I'm like, you told me where you live. They gave me the address. So I hope they got home okay. I think once they got to familiar streets, it'd be okay. But you know, in the desert, it's not always that simple. This was before GPS. You know, if you get lost and you run out of resources, so God forbid, that could be the end. So, an important point also, the Gemara concludes that if there's a minhag, if there's a certain tradition in terms of how to figure out costs, so you always follow that tradition. So if there's a precedent that, you know, it's a known thing that among people who are lost in the desert that you pay based on a flat fee or you pay based on wealth, and you can't break that rule. Meaning, the tradition is the tradition. The, you know, if that's what common practice is, that's what you follow. No, this is not the kind of minhag where Ashkenaz are svard. It's more like, you know, it's common practice in this area that this is what people do. If the Braisa, meaning the Gemara, is addressing cases where there may be two divergent practices or where there is no, this never happened before. But if there's an established practice, so then we would follow that. Okay. Another model, and this really introduces us to the concept of scholarship, or that wealth model based on what people can afford, as opposed to what stakes they have in the particular service, is the Gemara in Bava Basra in Source 2. This is a somewhat famous Gemara, so. So the Gemara talks about Yehoshua ben Gamla. So the name ben Gamla is not a new thing. Yehoshua ben Gamla lived during the time of the Tanaim, that he was around for a long time. So I think 2nd century, 3rd century, somewhere around that time. So what he did was he set up a system where every child can get an education. So originally the practice was that they didn't have teachers in each town. So originally the parents would teach the children Torah, but that, you know, that doesn't work out so well for parents who are working or parents who don't have the ability to teach their kids. So then they had a school system. But even that didn't work out so well because they didn't have schools in each town and they didn't have, you know, the transportation that we have. So you had to cross a river, you had to go to all these different places. So he said, you know what, we're going to have a local school system for each community. And they start at 6 and 7 years old. And I don't have it's a long piece in the Talmud, but the Gemara has details. And part of that is that the community kicks in part of the funds, whatever can't be made up for by the parents. That's the Rama in Shulchan Aruch points that out. That this is 1 second. The Rama in Choshen Mishpat 163 writes that the funds for a school should primarily be paid for by the parents, but the community should kick in whatever the parents can't afford. So that's a model. That's a fourth model, or really a third, because two of them were the same. So we have the membership model, meaning everyone pays the same thing. It's a flat fee, a service-based fee. The second model would be based on how much you benefit from it. So people who benefit more would pay more. People who benefit less would pay less. You know, imagine if in a shul it wasn't a membership model, it was more based on services. So the shul would raise its revenue. Okay, you come to mincha, you put in, you know, you buy tickets beforehand or whatever, or you swipe your credit card as you come into mincha every day. So you pay $5 each day for mincha. That would be the model that the Gemara is talking about in terms of how much benefit you get from the services. But again, we have certain institutions that do work like that. A mikveh charges based, you know, they don't get all the revenue based on use, but some of the revenue comes from the people who use it. If you use the shul for something you have a simcha in the shul and you want to rent out the room, so you pay for it because that's part of the revenue model is a service based model. And then the third model, which Rabbi Shimon Gamla, again, for schools it may be a different situation, but there is that idea that people who can afford more should pay more, people who can't afford as much can pay less, and then the community will kick in the rest. Okay, now's where we move to other institutions besides schools. Okay, that in source 3, the Tosefta writes that that you can force, the people of the city can force each other to build a shul and to buy a Sefer Torah and Nevi'im. Again, we have our leniencies why we don't have authentic Navi scrolls, so we don't necessarily buy those. But the Sefer Torah, you need a Sefer Torah to have a minyan on Shabbos and Monday and Thursday, and you need a shul to daven. So if there are 8 people in town and 2 others don't want to pay for a shul, they'd rather not have a shul, so you can force them. What does it mean you can force them? So in previous, there were times in Jewish history where Jews had autonomy and they could literally force others to do it. But what it means is that the guy who says, you know, I don't want to pay for the shul, I'd rather just have it at home. So we tell him, sorry, that's not the right thing to do. You should be paying for the shul. Okay, what else is included in this? So Rishon and Marami Rundberg and others talk about, the Tosefta elsewhere talks about building an Eruv, that an Eruv is also included in one of these things, a mikvah. There's a discussion even about hospitals. In theory, if there was no way to treat people medically, so then the community would have to get together and build a hospital. So there are things that are necessary in a community and can only be provided locally, need to be taken care of by the local residents. Now, keep in mind also that the communities back then might have been more like homeowners associations, in that they were exclusively Jewish. And so when we talk about Kof and B'nai Ha'ir, it's the entire city. So the entire city, you know, it's a Jewish community. Everyone pretty much has the same needs. And so part of dues for the homeowners association would be to build that shul that's in the association or the city and the other things that are necessary for that community. Okay. The Marami Rutenberg quoted in the Hagos Maimoni in Hilchos Tefillah Perek Yud Aleph says the following: that you see from the fact that you can force each other to build a shul that you can also force each other to make a minyan. Now watch what happens. There's 10 people in the town. Exactly 10 people in the town. And if one guy wants to go away for Shabbos, so not a problem, you'll hire somebody else to come. Okay? Now what if there are 11 people in the town and two guys want to go away for Shabbos? So you should say, well, they only need to hire one. Those two guys should split it amongst themselves. That's fine, and that's the halacha. What if one of them is wealthy, one of them is poor? It doesn't matter. They both want to go away for Shabbos. This has nothing to do with money, right? And I think the point is that they are obligated to be. If they're only 11 people in town, they're obligated to show up to shul. The Rama even talks about that in certain times. Where is it? The Rama is in Orach Chaim Siman Nunhei. He talks about the fact that you can actually impose fines. If there's not enough people in town, you can make a rotation or whatever. You can make sure that everyone comes to shul. You can impose fines on people who don't show up because they're, you know, there's not going to be a minyan. So there's an obligation, a personal obligation. If there's only 11 people in town, there's a personal obligation on everyone to show up. So if two people go away, that's for their own convenience. It has nothing to do with, you know, this guy can afford more and this guy can afford less. It makes sense that it's a service. It should be based on their benefit because they're both obligated to show up, and therefore they split it. What about a chazan? Who should pay? And it's interesting here that you see that they dealt with the expenses of the shul like one individually, as opposed to, you know, the shul has to pay X amount of dollars for their annual budget. Let's figure it this way. They actually split it up sort of piecemeal or individually. So what about the cost of the chazan? So they hire a chazan. Now, should everyone pay the same, or should the wealthier people pay more? Should the wealthier people pay the same as everybody else? So the Maram says, and this is a compromise that exists, this is a famous compromise. It seems to be based on the Rush that I quoted earlier. Well, the Rush was a student of the Maram, so it wouldn't surprise you. That you do 50-50, meaning 50% of the cost of the chazan is based on a flat fee, meaning everyone splits that part evenly. The other 50% is based on wealth. Why should that be? So he says that the wealthier people are more tied to their homes, and the people who aren't as wealthy are not as tied to their homes. So they'll say, wait, I don't want to hire a chazan. I'd rather move. This is not a case where there are 11 people. So there are 50 people in town. So the wealthier people have, whatever it is, you know, it might not be the same nowadays. Now it could be that the wealthier people are less tied to their homes. But in those days, if you had a farm, if you had a big farm, you couldn't just pick up and leave. If you were a worker, so you could go somewhere else and find a job. So the wealthier people were more tied to their homes. And therefore, the people who weren't as wealthy will say, look, you know, you want to hire a chazan, that's great, but I'm out of here. I'm going somewhere else. And I'll go to a place where they don't have to pay for a chazan. So that's where the idea of wealth comes from. Meaning it's not really based on assistance, that the wealthier people should pay for the people who aren't as wealthy. It's the idea that there's a logical reason why the wealthier people want the chazan more than the people who aren't as wealthy. The Rashba It's in the source sheet. And source number 4 discusses this as well. And he's talking about a chazan or a shamish, whether it should be based on wealth or whether it should be a flat fee for everyone. So he says that, well, when we talk about a chazan or a cantor, you have to think of it on two levels. One is that there were people who didn't know how to daven at all. They didn't know how to pray, and they needed that chazan because nobody could do it in his stead. That was it. They didn't have, this was before the printing press, they didn't have siddurim. So you needed a guy. It wasn't always easy to find somebody to get up there and daven. That's on a basic level. But then, you know, once you're hiring someone, you're not going to get a guy that sings like a frog. You're going to get somebody with a good voice, and you want someone who's going to please the crowd. So who wants that more? You think the people who are strapped for cash, so they're going to say, look, you know, just get us anyone. We'll be fine with whatever you get is good. We recognize that we need a chazan, but we don't want to spend extra money for a guy with a good voice, especially if shul's going to end later. And the wealthier people are saying, no, we want to have a nice chazan. So the Rashba says, fine, you want to have a nice chazan, you pay for it. And he says not only that, but that they might be obligated, because there's a concept of hiddur mitzvah, that we do mitzvahs beautifully. So if somebody can afford, let's say a fancier esrog, or whatever object we're using for a mitzvah. So if somebody could do a mitzvah in a more beautified manner and they can afford it, then they might be obligated to do it. Somebody who can't afford to, so they shouldn't spend money, you know, a person who doesn't have any money to spend shouldn't spend $100 per pound on matzah. You know, whereas the wealthy person may want to buy such a fancy set. Obviously there's a market for it. So the Rashba's model is, it makes sense that the things that are niceties, things that people want more, so then those are... Those should be paid for by people who can afford it, because those are the people who should be paying for it. Yeah.
Okay. So to go back to one of your favorite topics, schools, you mentioned.
Yeah.
Two things. One, how does this relate, if you have some people that say, I want to have a very fancy school opposed to a basic school, do you force the community then to have to pay more for all the extras? And then secondly, what about the way schools approach it today, where they'll charge, for people who could afford it, they'll charge the cost, and then force those people that could afford it to pay an extra amount for other people that can't afford it.
Right. So you are involving a third, meaning there's a third party here now, because the schools, we said, the community has to kick in for part of it. So the Gemara already says that if you're asking the community to kick in, meaning, and when we talk about the community, it's not necessarily the parents, other parents in the school, it's the community as a whole. So then they have to abide by certain, guidelines. So the Gemara already talks about that. They can't have classes that are less than, again, it's a machlokas tosus and the Ramban. Can you have small classes? But they say that the classes should go up to 50 people. Again, there's a discussion whether that should be applied nowadays or whether you should make the numbers small. I think the consensus is that you can't have a class with 50 people anymore. You have to try to reduce costs in a way that makes sense if you're going to ask other people to kick in terms of asking parents to pay more. So there is, this idea of lefia mamon v'lefia nefashos, meaning that people can afford more should pay more. It does exist to a certain extent. You know, meaning if the people who are wealthier want to have all these niceties, then they should pay. That's the rash, but they should pay for it, and the people who can't afford it shouldn't. If it works out like that. If it doesn't work out like that, that the wealthier people would also rather not have them, and then it's the other people who want it. So then they should pay for it.
That's beyond just going to the community.
Right.
That's right to the smaller stuff.
Right, right. It's assuming, though, that's assuming like a partnership model, that the parents are all in it together as a partnership. We're going to figure out what people want. You know, if it happens to be that the wealthier people want to have more extra, after school activities and more of this and more of that, so then it makes sense that
you... Before, it's nice to do it, but then it's maybe
right. So then the question is, what what percentage of people, you know, who do you poll in terms of whether they want it or not, and how do you figure that out? And I'll get to that in a second. I don't have so much time. Rabbeinu Yerucham actually has another consideration. He says you should bring up three things. Are you, you know, like the Rashba, are you paying because the guy has a nice voice, or are you paying just because you need a body to get up there and daven every day? Number two, which is probably something we could all relate to, and this discussion always comes up, what happens to the property values when you have a good chazan? So, again, you would have never thought it would come up in the 13th century, but that's what he says. He says the wealthier people are saying, look, we'll get the chazan, and don't worry. You know, you can't afford it. Your property values will go through the roof once this guy comes in, and our shul is going to grow, and then the community is going to grow. So that's what he says. So the wealthier people will, you know, assuming they're the property owners, they're the ones who really stand to gain. Then he says also, and this, you know, I guess is a historical point, that the chazan generally spends more time with the wealthier people in terms of his other duties. So if they're the ones who are directly going to benefit more, then they should pay for that. Rabbi Yehuda Mintz discusses in terms of how to determine, meaning, is it 50-50? Is it, meaning, who gets to decide in the end? Is it a board? Is it based on what people want? So he says that you go by a majority. Meaning, if majority of people in the shul want something, so that's going to be the determination whether you should have it or not. So if everyone wants to renovate, if 51% of the people want to renovate, so then you go ahead with the renovation. In terms of figuring out how to pay for it, so then you go with the other models. But majority is something important here. That the majority rules. Okay, just a few quick points, and then we'll wrap it up. There's a discussion about paying for a rabbi. So where does that money come from? Where does the discussion come up? Because, well, let's just back up for a second. Rav Moshe Alshich, the Alshich, talks about a community where some people said, you know what, we don't want to pay for the mikveh because we don't use it anymore. They were postmenopausal, or they were single, or whatever it was, they didn't want to pay for it. So he says you can't do that. The community needs a mikvah, and even the people who don't normally use it, but everyone uses it on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. It's an interesting point. Meaning, even without that, I would say they could argue that it's a communal need. It's not something which it's not something which individuals can opt to have or not. Again, like we said, the mikveh can charge based on use, and if they raise most of their money, if most of their revenue comes from people who use it, so fine, but that doesn't generally work out. They're going to have to raise money from the community, and it's an important need for the whole community. They should try to get it from everyone.
Everything based on shalom bayit, the whole, doesn't it affect the whole community?
Yeah, I mean, it's right. The assumption is that even if he didn't say that thing about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that everyone should pay for the mikveh. So then the discussion comes up, what about a rabbi? So everyone needs a rabbi, of course, right? So the Chasam Sofer points out that if the rabbis, and again, rabbis over history had different roles. So he says if the rabbi's only job is to answer halachic questions, so then you could argue, look, we don't really need a rabbi because really everybody should be learned enough to answer the questions themselves. So it's not an inherent communal need. But if the rabbi has other functions, which every rabbi nowadays does, whether it's to counsel people or to attend simchas or officiate at funerals, etc. So everyone needs a rabbi, and everyone's going to turn to him when they need that service, even if they don't need it this year or the year after or whatever. Everyone is going to use the rabbi for something, so then everyone has to pay for it. But it's interesting that if it was just for halacha questions, so then you could argue that that we should all be learned enough that we wouldn't need a rabbi. Okay, so one more point, and then we'll get back to our cases. The Trumas HaDeshen of Yisrael Isserlin, who lived between 1390 and 1460, writes that now when you talk about volunteering, so let's say there's something which, and he's talking about having people, they had turns guarding the city. So people took shifts walking around the city to protect the city. And then, you know, like our case that we discussed, some people said, you know what, I don't want to spend my nights guarding the city, I'm going to hire somebody else. And then all of a sudden it became more convenient to just hire guards in general. So he says that if it's something that everybody can do, then you can't force people who want to volunteer to pay for it. If people are willing to volunteer, and that was what was set up, then you can't force other people to pay for it. If it's not something that everybody can do, and you're going to have to hire anyway, so then you can move already to employing people if that's more cost effective. And so we'll skip to that case. In case two, that's basically the case that we have, that people, you know, you had volunteers for a kiddush, and every week people would clean up. But some people decided they didn't want to do that. So according to the Truma Sedeshin, you can't force the people who were volunteering to say, you know what, why don't you guys pay also to have the cleaning help? They want to do it themselves. And it's not just to save money. They want to do it because that's part of growing the shul, to, you know, to feel loyal to the shul. So you shouldn't stop that. But a more common situation with that is, you know, shuls can, especially smaller shuls, so they'll use volunteers based on their expertise. So you'll have one guy who's the computer guy, and one guy who's the attorney, and one guy's the accountant. So that gets a little more tricky, because it's not, you're not asking them to do things that that other people can do. So can you sort of impose on people to do that, or should we just say, no, look, let the whole community pay for it, let them pay for my services? Again, it would be the right thing to do, would be to offer the services, but if somebody doesn't want to, then they shouldn't. I have time for a quick joke. Okay, quick joke, and then we'll move to cases one and three. So there was a doctor in shul, and he went over to his friend, the lawyer, and he said, you know, I need your help really badly. I can't daven anymore. The whole davening, I get people coming over to me and telling me about this and about that, and it's getting so out of hand. So the lawyer says, let me tell you what I do. Anytime somebody asks me a question, I just send them a bill right after. So he goes, oh, what a great idea. So he runs home. He's so excited to tell his wife. And just as he's about to tell his wife, he gets an email with an invoice from his friend, the lawyer. Okay. So moving on back to case number one. So case number one was half the shul wants to renovate. Or let's say about half the shul wants to renovate, about half the shul doesn't want to renovate. So the first thing to do is bring it up to a vote, or sort of take a poll and see where's the majority. If more than half of the people want it, so then you follow the majority. Then in terms of figuring out how to pay for it, so then you would go with the wealthier people pay more, the people who can't afford it pay less, because again, the wealthier people, for whatever reason, either because of the property values or because they want it more, or because they're required to spend more for their shul, so they're required to pay more. And then you can, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be through membership dues. It could be that you have a campaign and you ask the people who are wealthier to pay more, and then that would be a legitimate tax deduction as opposed to membership. But they should be, in the end of the day, they should be contributing more than the others. Case number three was the community Erev. So, like we said, if there's an established minhag, if there's an established minhag, meaning there's a precedent that every shul in that case was paying a flat fee. So the people who are arguing we should continue with the flat fee, in a way they are correct. However, if the situation, and the situation here is kind of unique in that they were, you know, they were paying a flat fee because it was such a minimal fee that it didn't really matter. But now that it's getting kind of expensive, so maybe the argument can go the other way, that there's not really an established tradition here. There was no tradition, and that the people, the larger shul should pay more, and the shul that's not as large should pay less. An interesting sort of sidebar here also is, what if you have a shul that just doesn't hold the Eruv? So this happens. There are communities where, you know, let's say certain Sephardic communities, like, they just won't use the Erev at all. So should they pay as well? So if they absolutely will never use it, then you have to ask why they're paying now. meaning they were paying until now, should they be exempt? But if they were never paying and now all of a sudden they're called upon to do it, so if they don't use it at all, so then the only reason you could say is maybe the property values. You know, you tell them, look, you know, if we don't have an Erev here, granted you're not going to use it, but nobody else is going to move in and your property values, but I don't know if that's such a great argument. But in general, that's not the case. Usually, even when people don't use the Erev, it's not that they don't use it at all. They'll use it in a pressing situation. They'll use it occasionally. They'll let their kids use it. So if people benefit from it, then they should contribute to some extent. So just to summarize, we had three models. Three basic models. One is to charge basically a membership model. Everyone pays the same thing for whatever institution you're running. Another is based on services, like the mikveh. You know, you show up, you use it one time, you pay for it. And again, it'll be a hybrid model because that's not going to cover all of the costs, but it'll cover a good part of the costs. And a shul also. You know, they'll rent out the catering hall. They'll bring in revenue. Certain things based on services, and then the rest based on membership. And then the third model is based on wealth. Wealthier people generally tend to benefit more from the extra services, and therefore they should pay more. Or because it's the right thing to do, that when the community doesn't have enough money to pay for everything, you should turn to the wealthier people as a form of tzedakah, not just because they benefit more, but because they should be giving more tzedakah in general to the community. Thank you.